The Parent Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM.
Neave Solicitors are proud to sponsor The Parent Show. The friendly team at Neave's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit neavesolicitors.co.uk. Neave Solicitors, your complete legal solution.
Welcome. It's The Parent Show. Thank you for joining us. It is Thursday. We're here again every week. This week, we're celebrating the return of our children to school. What would you say, Lorenza?
Both, really. Kind of relief and then wondering where to start to get back to work.
That's right. I mean, there's so many mixed emotions, aren't there? I mean, we're basically celebrating the fact, well, I am, that the summer's over and the childcare has come to an end and our little darlings are back in full-time education.
Yes, I was quite relieved. But, so, you know, we've had a good time.
This is a little bit of a return to school show, and I think we should all give ourselves a very big round of applause, a slap in the back, because as parents, we've made it through. Most of the schools have started back, and that's why we're going to play a little celebratory song before we come back with our main interview of the night, when we're talking this evening about vaccinating our children. So we'll be joined in the studio by Dr. Halvorsen from Baby Jabs, the Children's Immunisation Service in Harley Street, London. Welcome back to The Parent Show. Well, they're all back at school, so the Boomtown Rats probably had it right. They all hated going back, but the mums and dads are celebrating all over Hertfordshire and elsewhere. Now, joining us in the studio tonight, we've got Lorenza Bacino.
Hello,
I have to say it like
evening.
That, Lorenza,
you
our fabulous Bacino. Local parent. And we've also got Dr. Halvorsen from Baby Jabs Immunisation Service in Wimpole Street. He corrected me in the break, in London. Dr. Halvorsen is our expert interview tonight. He's the medical director of the Baby Jabs Clinic. Now, before we start having a chat, I just wanted to say a couple of hellos very, very quickly to Gemma McCarran, who's tuning in from Manx. And from further afield tonight, we actually have listeners in the States. So very good afternoon. And why are they tuning in? Well, it's not to listen to me rattling on. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a very important topic, aren't we, Lorenza?
We are, and we're talking to Dr. Halvorsen, who's worked as a GP in central London for over 20 years, and he wanted to give all parents the opportunity to choose which vaccines to give their child, and also when they should be given, a choice that's certainly not available with the NHS schedule. This led to the formation of a dedicated children's immunisation service, Baby Jabs, in 2007. He's written The Truth About Vaccines, which was first published in 2007, and an expanded and updated edition was published in 2009.
So welcome to the studio. Richard, can I call you Richard?
Thank you very much. Please do. Thank you very much, Kathy and Lorenza,
for
inviting me.
Thank you for coming.
Pleased to be out here in sunny St Albans.
Well, we've had lots of chats over the last few days about the subject of vaccinations. I have to say it's been one of the most complex areas for me to research for a parent show. There's just an enormous amount on the internet, and it's very hard to decipher, very hard to make head nor tail of. I mean, I got out my old vaccination book for my child just to have a read through and have a look. You're in such a blur when you have your first baby, aren't you, Lorenza? And they say, oh, you've got to get them vaccinated in a couple of months, and you know, you're horrified.
But I did what I was told.
You sort of do what you're told. You've no idea what they're being vaccinated against. I certainly didn't, and you just sort of have to. You know, it's a horrible thing to do, isn't it, as a new mom?
Well, you have
mom,
to hold them down and it feels all brutal awful. And you feel like you're hurting them, but you kind of, you do what you're told,
So that's really the stance we came from, isn't it? I know nothing else about vaccinating children, so we're going to have a little discussion tonight about that whole subject. But we know from your website, Richard, that you set up Baby Jabs because of your concern about the increasing number of vaccinations given to babies.
That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it all started really when I was doing a bit of medical journalism in my earlier days, and my commissioning editor of a national Sunday newspaper asked me to do a story on the MMR vaccine, and this was probably nearly two decades ago now, 15 years ago or so, and I said, why? What's the problem? What's the problem with the MMR vaccine? I use it all the time. It's fine, isn't it? Well, she said, I think there might be something in it. And she gave me a couple of numbers. To contact, one of whom is now the infamous Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who we could talk about him if you wish, but let's leave that for now. Anyway, and I researched into it and talked to these people, and there was this thing about MMR and autism, and I thought, well, there's something in it here, maybe. you know, I'm not convinced, but you know, maybe there's a link, I suppose. And then I thought, well, I'll talk to the Department of Health, and I'm sure I'll be reassured that I've done lots of safety studies, and that'll be fine. And there was, so I asked the Department of Health what safety studies there were, and it appeared there'd been virtually no safety studies at all. The longest that any safety studies had been done about for the MMR were 2 weeks long. And I thought, well, you can't pick up autism after 2 weeks, can you? That's not very impressive. So I thought, well, there was no evidence supporting the safety of the MMR, and there was a little bit of evidence thought it might be a problem, and so that made me a bit uneasy. And I thought, well, if the MMR is introduced with so little safety trials, what about other vaccines? Are they any better? Are they worse? And so I ended up spending 5 years investigating the whole topic for my book, The Truth About Vaccines, found a lot, some of which really quite unnerved me, to be honest.
Before we start talking about the controversies surrounding the MMR, can we go back to basics and looking at it from a parental point of view? So does it vary from vaccine to vaccine how much protection a child gets? Can you just outline very basically how long are children protected?
Do you want me
for?
To list, go through briefly through the vaccines that children have, first of all? Would that be helpful?
Yeah, briefly, and how long?
And then,
yeah, I mean, I've got my son's vaccine. Yeah. Every parent is familiar with the Red Book, and you can see some of the vaccines there, Richard, that parents know their child has had.
Children start off being vaccinated. In some places, they'll get the BCG vaccine against TB at birth. Now, that almost certainly does not happen in St Albans because there won't be too much TB around here. So St Albans babies and Hertfordshire babies will start off at 2 months when they'll get two injections against six different diseases. And that's diphtheria, which is a very rare but serious throat illness. Tetanus, which is a rare but serious disease that is caught from contaminated soil. Whooping cough, which has been in the news recently and is actually quite common. It's actually quite common because the vaccine doesn't work very well, but we can get round to that if you like. Polio, which is a diarrhea and vomiting bug that can cause paralysis. There was big epidemics of it in the 1950s. It's been eradicated from the UK and Europe now. HIB, Haemophilus influenza type B, which is a bug that can cause meningitis. It's uncommon, but not really rare, but it can cause nasty diseases like meningitis and blood poisoning. And pneumococcal disease, which is a similar bug that can also cause nasty things like meningitis. Then they get another two sets of vaccines against six diseases at 3 months of age, which is virtually the same, except instead of the pneumococcus, they get the meningococcus, meningitis C, which is a similar sort of disease that can cause meningitis. Then at 4 months of age, they get three injections against seven different diseases, which again is the same ones that we've all had. That's all, and then till 12 months, and then they get boosters, and then the MMR.
From talking to you, just having a chat with you before, you seem to be quite against giving so many jabs at such a young age. Why?
Well, I think probably for most people it's fine. But we are adding more and more vaccines to the immunisation schedule. Now children get 25 vaccines by the age of 13 or 14 months. And what concerns me is that I don't hear any debate about what might be maximum or too much. 30, 50, 100? All I hear is that the most senior doctor in the country has said publicly that children can receive 1,000 vaccines in one go. And that makes me really twitchy because I think that sounds crazy.
But there's also the question of, I mean, you've mentioned, I can certainly understand the argument that some of those diseases seem to be almost, you know, extinct in this part of the world. Are you worried that it's never been revised, the schedule, the immunisation schedule, that they just keep loading them up and they're not subject to change over time?
It's very easy to introduce vaccines, Kathy. It's actually quite difficult to take them off the schedule. And whilst, you know, vaccines save lives, absolutely no question about that. I wouldn't be running an immunisation clinic if I didn't think the vaccines were of benefit. I would argue, why do you need to give a two-month-old baby a vaccine against polio, which has been eradicated from this country? There might be an argument for having it when they get a bit older, before they travel, but it doesn't make sense. Why give them a vaccine against tetanus, which they're not going to get until they're crawling around in the garden?
But isn't the idea to prevent it happening and just to get everyone in the same place at the same time so that we can keep more control over
the situation? It is all about control, and it is all about looking everyone at the same. And that's part of the problem. It assumes that everyone is the same. And the majority of children will tolerate the vaccines perfectly well, will be absolutely fine with them, they'll get all the benefit from them, and they won't get any side effects. But we know side effects happen, and we know serious side effects can, albeit rarely, thank God, happen. And we know that because there is a vaccine injury compensation program that compensates for severely disabled children.
In fact, in the Times yesterday, there was a case about deafness caused. There was a compensation sought for one of the vaccines. I can't remember which one it was.
So I'm not suggesting for a moment that serious injury after vaccination is common. It's rare, thankfully. But what does worry me is that the more and more vaccines we introduce, which is what we're doing, the more children are going to be affected by them.
So it's really the volume that they're receiving that you'd be concerned about.
I think that's part of the issue. Yeah, that's part of the issue.
There's also the question of the efficacy, isn't there, of the vaccines? I mean, you've mentioned, well, first of all, I wanted to make a point about their response that some children will have an adverse reaction to the vaccine. But isn't that the same for all drugs? I mean, how do we know? I mean, I certainly don't remember any warnings given about how responsive your child might be to a vaccine, do you? Or
they did say, they might need Calpol for a fever
that's all I'm aware of.
What, aside from the MMR controversy and the autism debate, what are some of the side effects that we're talking about here then?
Well, we get into a very difficult area here because, of course, we know about relatively common side effects of vaccines, and you talked about the temperatures and swollen arms and swollen legs where the vaccines are given, and feeling a bit irritable and that sort of thing. But that doesn't worry parents too much. What they want to know is, look, is my son or daughter going to be severely damaged? Are they going to have any long-term immune problems and that sort of thing? And that, by and large, we just don't know because the research just isn't done. And part of the problem is that the vast majority of research into vaccines, as in it is to drugs as well, is organised and funded by the large pharmaceutical companies. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of it, to be absolutely frank, is to get their vaccine or drug licensed and to sell it. Yes. They're in the business of selling. They're not actually in the business of protecting our health. I'm not suggesting they're out there to do harm, but once they've got their vaccine license, they're not going to spend a lot of money doing long-term safety studies that might throw up a problem that would only be bad for business.
Is it also true that vaccines contain mercury and aluminium, talking about harmful things?
The vaccines certainly, in this country anyway, the vaccines that were commonly used did all contain mercury until a little under 10 years ago, when they were taken out after there was a bit of an outcry based in the United States initially about the health effects of mercury, which is an extraordinary toxic metal. What on earth it's doing in children's vaccines in the first place is really, one has to wonder, because it was able to be removed without any problem whatsoever. So thankfully that has been taken out. Aluminium is of concern. That is also a toxic metal. Aluminium can cause brain damage. I'm not suggesting that the aluminium in vaccines can necessarily cause brain damage, but we know aluminium can, and we know that aluminium is in the majority of vaccines being used, and that could be a concern in some children.
But isn't it the case that the dosages, say, of those contaminants are so low that they're not harmful to humans? Is that a valid argument?
Well, Cathy, that's what they thought about mercury, because it was 0.05% of the vaccine, and they thought, well, that's such a titchy amount, that can't possibly do any harm. And then they worked out what it was in micrograms, and they suddenly thought, oh my God, it actually could. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they've been giving it for about 50 years without doing the calculation. With aluminium, it sounds like a very small amount, but there's a huge thing about aluminium is that you cannot compare it with the aluminium that we ingest, that we swallow, or that we eat, because 99.9%, or virtually all of it, is not absorbed into the gut. The gut has a protective barrier, whereas what is injected is all taken into the body. So it's about 1,000 times, at least, more potent than the aluminium you ingest. Yeah. Therefore, the tiny amounts that we think we're injecting are actually significantly more.
Aside from mercury and aluminium, are there other contaminants? Are there other things that parents should take into consideration that could contaminate vaccinations?
Well, all vaccines, Lorenza, have potentially nasty things that we don't know much about and are just not researched. The trouble is they've got into vaccines just by default, and no one's researched whether they're a problem or not. Formaldehyde is a common constituent of vaccines. Phenoxyethanol, other preservatives, antibiotics are quite often used. Most of these might well be fine, but some could be problematic, especially when given with other things as well.
I mean, is there such a thing, it's probably a ridiculous question, as a sort of an organic vaccine? Is there anything, or is there any way of receiving such a barrier for our children that doesn't contain such?
More modern vaccines are higher tech and are being made with less additives in them, which is a good thing, because then at least we can discount the potential adverse reaction side effects of those additives that are potentially problematic. But you've still got the vaccine itself, the antigen itself, the active product, and that still has the potential to cause prop damage to the immune system, which it is designed to affect.
I mean, is one of the difficulties, it's very, very hard to separate out all the things that can poison our children's system. They live in polluted cities. They're eating food that isn't always the best. I mean, life's full of poisons, exposure to chemicals.
Everywhere.
Where do we begin protecting them from those sorts of toxins?
I've no idea, and I'm not going to try and advise you, because now you're verging off from vaccines, which,
which
is what I've come
digressing
to talk about. So I'm not going to attempt to try and lead you through that jungle.
But what about, let's go back to the efficacy argument, because obviously the media this week have been looking at the rising measles cases, rising whooping cough.
As well. Mm.
With the whooping cough, I mean, my child's been vaccinated against it. Is he going to be safe from it?
From whooping cough?
Yeah.
No, not at all. Whooping cough is one of the least effective vaccines. It's about 50% effective, probably. You know, so, you know, that's not very effective. That means it'll prevent about half the children who receive a full course from getting it. To be absolutely fair to the vaccine, what it is likely to do, it's likely to make it a milder form of illness in the other people who get it.
Okay.
So it's likely to ameliorate the strength of the disease, mm-hmm. Even if it doesn't prevent it. Also, it doesn't last very long. It wears off fairly quickly. So after a few years, the effect will fall off. Children are then given a booster at about 3.5-4 years of life, and that then probably falls off by the time they get in their teens, and then they become susceptible again.
So as us adults are just as susceptible as...
You're probably pretty well just as susceptible as if you've never been vaccinated, to be honest.
Right.
Yeah.
And can we ask about the MMR? We've discussed it a little bit, but what is the difference between giving your child the MMR and giving them single vaccine, say, at your clinic? They end up with all the vaccines in their system anyway. What is the big issue about them being joined together like that?
Well, those of us who have concerns about the MMR, and I have to be careful here because I've had my knuckles wrapped only last month by the Advertising Standards Agency for intimating that there could be a link between MMR and autism on my website. But those of us who have a concern that the MMR may be one of the less safe vaccines, we think it's because it's the only vaccine in existence that has three live vaccines in one go. In other words, you're giving hundreds of thousands of live measles bugs, hundreds of thousands of live mumps bugs, and hundreds of thousands of live German measles bugs all together, all mixed together in the same go. And whilst that may not be dangerous itself, it means that those bugs have the potential to interact in ways that we may not have foreseen.
Mm-hmm. But going back to it's Dr. Wakefield, wasn't it? And that report was discredited. Talk us through that then. What happened? He was struck off, but 10 years down the track, this argument is still raging. Why can't we lay this to rest? And why are people still saying there is a link? Statistically, what proof is there?
My view is that there's no smoke without fire. We have no conclusive scientific proof that the MMR causes autism. Let's be quite clear about that.
Why can't we have the scientific proof?
Because,
why don't we have it?
Well, the research is not being done. The only research that would really show that is just very expensive and would involve following up tens of thousands of children, and some would have to be given the MMR and some would have to be not given the MMR, and they'd have to be followed up for 5 years at least. and that research is very expensive, and it would even be deemed to be unethical, because it would be, people would say, you're depriving those children of the vaccines. But I don't want to dwell too long on them. We could spend all day talking about indeed, it, let alone your programme about the MMR. But Andrew Wakefield was struck off. His research was not condemned when he was struck off. He was deemed to have broken ethical guidelines, and he was shown, open quotes, callous disregard, close quotes, which is the title of a book he wrote, to the children. In other words, he investigated them, caused pain, unnecessary suffering to these children. What I find strange is that not one parent of those children ever complained that he had harmed them. In fact, the parents of those children he'd investigated were standing outside the General Medical Council supporting him. So it just doesn't ring true to me.
In view of what you're saying, you've set up your baby jabs clinic in Wimpole Street. What do you do at your clinic? What's different about it?
Well, what we do is offer parents choice. On the NHS, there is no choice when it comes to vaccines. Anything else you go to the doctor with, he might discuss with you, well, we could do this, we could have an operation, we could refer you to the surgeon, we could refer you to the physio. With vaccinations, this is the way you do it. For all children, what we've just talked about. 6 vaccines at 2 months, 6 vaccines in 2 injections at 3 months, 7 vaccines in 3 injections at 4 months. That's the only way you can have it, although you don't have it at all. So what I offer is give parents the opportunity to do things differently. They can have them in smaller amounts, they can spread them out a bit more, they can leave some out till later, they can leave some out completely if they wish. I give them the opportunity to make an informed choice.
So, Richard, but when somebody comes into your clinic, how do you possibly decide or tailor? How would my child be different from Lorenz's? How do you decipher that to make a judgment about the vaccines that they might receive?
Well, I would take a personal history of the child. I would find out what the health was like of the child. I take a, often, there's not usually much wrong, because we're talking about babies here, thankfully. Then I take a family history. I'd want to know, for example, if there are any immune disorders, allergies, autoimmune disorders in the parents. And, for example, if both the parents suffered quite bad asthma, I would say to them, well, there is some research that suggests that if you wait and don't vaccinate your baby, don't start vaccinating until 5 months of age, we will reduce his or her risk of getting asthma by at least 50%. And that's a big reduction. And asthma, remember, is not necessarily a mild illness. Asthma kills children. So whilst there is a potential disadvantage of waiting 5 months, you're leaving them an extra 3 months unprotected, you are significantly reducing their risks of getting asthma. And I'll sort of talk through these things with them. I'll usually have a consultation with the parents, and then we will come to a plan which they're happy to follow.
I must say, from a parent's point of view, I don't think I could ever, I'm not a medical person, I could never get to the bottom of all this or really, really understand.
Yeah.
And from my point of view, I'd rather be told what to do. I want to know what the right thing to do is. I don't want to be given a choice. I don't want, I feel
far too complex,
overwhelmed by choice. I must say, I just want someone to tell me what the right thing to do is. And why do I need a choice as a parent?
No, choice is a problem. Choice is difficult.
It is a problem.
I totally agree with you. And many of the parents I see say, oh my God, I wish I'd never started exploring this. Because if I'd just done what I was told, and I would have been in ignorant bliss. But having opened the Pandora's box, having done the research, having looked on the internet, having discovered that vaccines can cause problems as well as being good. You can't shut that Pandora's box again. You can't but unlearn what you've learnt, and you have to follow it through.
But then that's not available on the NHS, so it's only going to be available to people who can pay for it.
Sadly, it is. Sadly, it is. When I was an NHS GP, I offered this to my patients free of charge on the NHS, but that was extremely rare and unusual. I'm just trying to make the point that I'm not out there just for the money. I believe passionately in offering that choice. And in fact, I made a loss by doing it on the NHS. But I thought it was the right thing to do. That's why I did it.
Is there any argument? I know there's no legal requirement to have your child vaccinated, but in your mind, isn't there an ethical argument?
There are ethical arguments, most certainly. It's for the greater good. And I think that is one of the bigger arguments, in fact, is to vaccinate healthy children who are probably not going to get severely ill from the diseases in the first place in order to prevent the vulnerable children with chronic health problems, poor socioeconomic conditions, who are more likely the ones who are going to die from meningitis, to protect them so they can't get the diseases. That is indeed one of the arguments, but it's quite a big ethical argument, and parents don't quite realise that that's sometimes why they are vaccinating it.
Well, I think we're going to have a little break now. Let us digest the lots of the information that we've been hearing.
Neave Solicitors are proud to sponsor the Parent Show. The friendly team at Neave's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit neavesolicitors.co.uk. Neave Solicitors.
Hi, and welcome back to the Parent Show, where we're talking about vaccination with Dr. Halvorsen. Now, we're going to take into consideration some listeners' questions now, and we've had a question about chickenpox in this country. Why isn't there a vaccine against chickenpox in this country? There is one in Australia. Is that something that your Baby Jabs clinic offers?
We do offer it for the very reason that we offer choice. So we give, you know, as well as giving parents the opportunity to have less, we give them the opportunity to have more if they so wish. And as you rightly suggest, chickenpox vaccine is not offered on the NHS in this country. It is offered routinely in some other countries, such as Australia, such as the United States, and Germany, I believe, offers it too. The majority don't. The reason that it's not offered in this country is certainly partly cost effectiveness, because that's considered about with all the introduction of vaccines, but also because there is some concern that if we immunise all the children against chickenpox, there'll be less natural chickenpox virus circulating in the community. This then will not boost the immunity of older people, because they won't come across it naturally, and they might get more shingles. Which I know that might sound mad, but shingles is caused by the chickenpox virus. When we get chickenpox, the virus stays in with us, it never leaves us, and if we're unlucky, it'll manifest as shingles later on. So this is concerned that the shingles in older people might increase.
We were talking about that it's different in every other countries. What are some of the main differences that you've come across? Do we vaccinate more in the UK, for example, than elsewhere, or where are we on the scale of...
I think the United States are our chief vaccinators. They vaccinate against anything that moves, really. And they give quite a few vaccines to newborn babies as well, such as hepatitis B vaccine. We vaccinate quite a lot. Most of the diseases, certainly if you're talking about the developed world, most of the diseases overlap. There aren't huge differences. Main differences are probably about timing. We have the most compact schedule of anywhere in the world. 2, 3, and 4 months we've whacked in 19 vaccines by. Even in the United States, that gives an awful lot of them. They do it at 2, 4, and 6 months, rather than 2, 3, and 4 months, as we do. In the Scandinavian countries, they're even more cautious, and they do it at 3 months, 5 months, and 12 months. They'll give the very same vaccines that we give at 2, 3, and 4 months. So it really tells us that there isn't an absolute right way of doing it. They're just different options depending on your point of view.
Can we just, on the subject of chickenpox, we've had a listener question ask about chickenpox. She's not sure if her son, who's 3, has had the chickenpox or not.
Yeah.
And she wants to know, would that something you'd be able to tell?
Yeah, we could do a blood test to test the child's immunity.
Okay, so that's parents can find that information out. That's great.
It needs a blood test to be done.
Great.
Okay, another listener question is, my child has an egg allergy. Is it safe for him to be receiving vaccines?
Almost certainly it's safe to have all vaccines. When you say egg allergy, most egg allergies are not severe. If your child has an anaphylactic egg allergy, which is the most serious life-threatening type, which means that if any egg is eaten by the child, then the child's mouth swells up, the tongue swells up, and the child struggles to breathe, and it's life-threatening, then maybe one should be cautious with egg-containing vaccines, which include some flu vaccines, includes the MMR vaccine, though research does suggest that in general, even these children can receive them safely.
Okay.
And what about the issue of cost? If we want choice, we have to pay for it.
Yeah.
What do these single vaccines cost then?
Yeah, unfortunately you do. And I wish you didn't have to. I wish these choices were available on the NHS. But the cost of each vaccine is in the region of £100 or a little bit over. And that's each vaccine, not just a course of vaccine. So if you were to have the full schedule, all the vaccines that were on the NHS, but in smaller amounts and spread out, it would, over a period of a year or more, it would probably cost you over £1,000, I'm afraid.
That's quite something, isn't it?
Okay.
Though some of those vaccines, we can sometimes work with GPs so that some of them can be given by the GP free of charge.
Richard, another listener question. Do vaccines affect a child's natural immunity to diseases? Is it possible that with good nutrition we can increase our children's immunity? I mean, basically asking what else is in our armoury as parents? What else can we do to boost their immunity?
Oh, most certainly. We by bringing up a child healthily, yes, feeding them well, looking after them well, bringing them up in good socioeconomic conditions, they will have a better immune system. Breastfeeding as well, breastfeeding for as long as possible, really. All these things help boost the immune system and make children less susceptible to the serious illnesses.
Okay.
And what about many parents have asked about travelling to developing countries and not vaccinating their children. Would you consider that to be irresponsible?
Well, it depends. It depends if you're talking about the travel vaccines as additional or whether you're saying I haven't vaccinated against the primary vaccines. A lot of the travel vaccines actually are not even appropriate for very young children under 2 years of age, for example. So
if you're going to India, they're going to be pretty hefty requirements
Going to India, certainly you should have the polio vaccine that I was saying is not so essential at such a young age in this country.
Yeah.
Probably malaria prophylaxis is probably more important than most of the travel vaccines, to be honest.
And Richard, is that something when people come to your clinic, you would be able, if they tell you which country they're going to, you'd be able to advise on what additional vaccines
we'd be able to advise on additional vaccines, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We've had another question about the cervical jab for teens, which has been...
Yes, there was a couple of years ago, there was a case of the teenager dying after she'd received the jab. What's your view about this one?
Yes, that was
she would have had underlying health issues.
That was
surely,
a funny one. Yes, we were told that she had an underlying health problem from which she would have dropped dead at any time anyway.
Yes.
But this does bring up a broader issue that is interesting. If you just bear with me for a moment, it's that when anything serious happens after a vaccine. So here's a perfectly healthy child, has a vaccine, drops down dead. That's alarming. One has to think, well, maybe it's the vaccine's got something to do with it. And maybe the vaccine should thought to be a potential culprit until proved otherwise. That's what I would say on the sign of caution. However, the general view is that, well, it's a coincidence until proved otherwise. So most doctors would say, well, unless you can prove to me it's the vaccine, I won't accept it as the vaccine. It's just coincidence. So lots of side effects that probably are being caused by the vaccines are being dismissed. I know so many parents who have a vaccine, their children has a vaccine, their child has a vaccine. They get quite serious side effects and they're really quite poorly. They go along to the doctor and say, look, my child just hasn't been well since this vaccine. Don't you think it's got something to do with it? Oh, no. It's nothing to do with the vaccine. It's just coincidence. Now, it might be coincidence in lots of cases, but I think we're too cavalier at dismissing potential side effects rather than thinking, well, if a problem does occur after a vaccine, maybe the vaccine has caused it. Just going back to the cervical cancer jab, having made that little detour, I'm concerned that this vaccine has been introduced more to make billions of dollars for Merck and GlaxoSmithKline than it has done actually to benefit the health of our population. We won't know for 20 years whether or not it can actually protect against cervical cancer. What it does is it vaccinates against a virus, a sexually transmitted virus that is certainly is implicated in lots of cancer, no question. But we already have a very good cervical screening system that picks up the vast majority of cancers. Mm-hmm. Cervical cancer is far, far from one of the largest causes of death. As I say, I think this is a huge money spinner for the companies that have introduced the vaccines.
But is it true? My understanding is that virus could lie dormant and lots of us carry it, but nothing may happen.
Yeah. So. Most sexually active people will catch this virus at some stage.
So it's not necessarily going to turn into
No. In nearly all women, they will deal with it. They will get rid of the virus. Naturally. And in only a tiny minority will it go on to cause serious problems like cervical cancer.
So it does appear that it's not really a necessary thing to do if it's such a minority then.
I would argue that it may not be the most appropriate way of health promotion in this country at the moment.
Okay. Another listener question. What is Richard's view on pregnant women having jabs?
If I were a pregnant woman, I'd want to be very careful about what I put into my body from all sources, and that would certainly include vaccines, because, you know, we're more vulnerable in pregnancy. We're not more vulnerable as a pregnant woman. Well, I will never be vulnerable, but you as a pregnant woman are not more vulnerable per se, but you're carrying something that is terribly precious and vulnerable. It is your baby is developing and it's going through such a delicate stage that you wouldn't want to put anything that you thought could affect that into your body, and that would include any medicines. After all, you're advised virtually to take no medicines if you possibly can. Why have a vaccine either, unless it's absolutely essential?
And before we just talk about your book, which you've detailed all this information in, presumably, I just wanted, we've got another listener question, if you wouldn't mind, about meningitis. Her son was vaccinated as a baby against meningitis. She's not sure what type, the standard sort of. And he ended up getting bacterial meningitis.
Yeah.
And she's wondering what happens next. I mean, A, why wasn't he protected? And B, is there anything else she can do to get her sibling to not get the disease as well?
Well, there are many different causes of bacterial meningitis, which is the serious life-threatening type of meningitis. And we vaccinate against three of the more common types. Sadly, the most common and most serious type, which is the B meningitis type, there is no vaccine against. So if you get that, you have to let nature deal with it and hopefully recover, but there is no vaccine against it. But of course, even the diseases that you're vaccinated against, the vaccines are not 100% effective. There is no such thing as a 100% effective vaccine. The meningitis vaccines are probably about 80% or so, maybe 80 to 90% effective. So there'll be people vaccinated who are still not protected, unfortunately.
Okay. So is the best we can do as parents, as well as if you choose to vaccinate your children, boost their natural immunity with good eating, good nutrition?
Yep, look after them, look after them. Of course, feed them well. Try not to make too many trips to the fast food burger stores. That's right. Give them fresh, nutritious fruit, fresh green vegetables, and as I say, at the very early stages, breastfeed for as long as possible.
One more question before we move on to the book we were talking about, to the kids and the flu jab, which is going to be introduced for children soon. What's your view on children and the flu jab? Do they really need it?
Yes, this is interesting, because it looks like the next major addition to the National Childhood Immunisation Schedule is going to be the additional of an annual flu jab for all children from 2 through to 16 years of age. And children under about 9 are going to need two flu jabs every year, and then after 9 it becomes one. So children are going to get 20 or so flu jabs throughout their childhood. Now, the interesting thing is that no one is making any pretense that this is for the benefit of the children. It's not. Children do not die from flu, with very rare exceptions. The idea is so that this prevents flu circulating in the community. It prevents older people dying from flu, keeps people out of hospital, keeps people away from the GP surgeries. So it raises an important ethical question. Is it really right to be giving children so many flu jabs when they're not going to benefit, but we're benefiting a generation, or people two generations older than? Bearing in mind that though most children will be fine with them, again, there will rarely be serious side effects from the vaccine.
So is this possibly a knee-jerk reaction from this bird flu scare that's been hanging around for the last few years?
Possibly, but I think this has been something that's been on the cards for some time. In the United States, which we mentioned are the most enthusiastic vaccinators in the world, for example, they've been giving children annual flu jabs for some years now.
OK, Richard, we're running out of time, so tell us about your book and how parents can get access to it, and also your website.
My book is called The Truth About Vaccines, and it's the result of 5 years investigations into it, and talks about all the vaccines used in the childhood immunisation schedule and how they were introduced and why they were introduced and how effective they are, and if there are any problems with them, what sort of problems they are. It's just being reprinted at the moment, unfortunately, so which means it's not this minute, I think, available on Amazon, though it should be on back on again within days. If people are really desperate, they can contact Baby Jabs, which is my children's immunisation service, where we do have a few copies we're able to put out, which leads on to the Baby Jabs website, where there is lots of information on all the vaccines, all the diseases, and the service that we offer in Central London.
That is www.babyjabs.co.uk.
That's right.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you
certainly
for joining
been
us.
An eye opener.
That's a pleasure. Lovely to be with you.
Thank you so much for coming in. That's a nice little cheerful tune, bringing us out of a rather, intellectual show. We've been talking about vaccinating our children. It's with Dr. Halvorsen. Is that, I can never pronounce his name properly.
Richard Halvorsen.
If you want to listen back to that interview, it'll be up on iTunes tomorrow evening. But without further ado, because she's got a lot of information to pass on tonight, it's Claire Healy from Raring to Go.
I can
go.
Bring the intellect down, straight down. Don't
bring
worry
us
about
down
that.
To a different level.
Yeah, let's get on to a more human level where yeah. we all understand what's going on.
So tell us, Claire, what's up? The kids are back at school, but what's coming up in the weekend to follow?
Typically, the minute the kids go back to school, there's loads going on again all of a sudden. It's Heritage Open weekend this weekend. So there are lots and lots of activities, lots and lots of places around the area that are open. You can come up, obviously, to Radio Verulam. There's the listening pages. There's the Oaklands Mansion House, which has never been open before, on the Smallford campus of Oaklands College. Loads of things happening at the Cathedral, Redbournbury Watermill. Lots and lots of things happening. Go on the Heritage Open Days website, because they have you can search for events in the area and on specific days. It runs from tomorrow, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, so there are various different things going on. So a part of that, I'll come back to some of the different things that are happening. On Saturday, I don't know if you've ever been down to the Fiesta shop, the party shop on the Hatfield Road. It's a new party shop that's been open a year or so. They're celebrating their first anniversary between 10 and 2 on Saturday. It's at the top end of Hatfield Road, opposite the cemetery. And they're celebrating their first year with face painting, cupcakes, snacks and money off vouchers. So I would say if you're looking at party stuff, they're launching all their new party range, and it's worth popping in just for a bit of a wander down there, I would say, on Saturday. Also on Saturday, Butterfly World are having, now let me get this right, they're having a leaf cutter ant banquet. I'm not sure that means that the ants, you're eating the ants. I think the ants are eating their banquet. And David Bellamy, Professor David Bellamy, who is a patron of
David Bellamy.
Well, he's going to be down there on Saturday between...
So enthusiastic.
It's fantastic, isn't it? So between 2 o'clock on the Saturday, and then again on 12:30 till 2, David Bellamy's down there on the Saturday, and there's going to be an leafcutter ant parade and the banquet and a Bellamy barbecue.
Is he local or something?
No, but he's a patron of the Butterfly World Project, so he comes and does things fairly... once a year generally he's down there, so that actually will be a lovely day out. I think it's going to be a nice weekend, so that would be a nice thing to get involved in. And the other thing that there's a couple of other things. There is the open day down at St Albans Fire Station on Sunday between 12 and 4. They've got a special teddy bear parachute. So bring your teddies for the teddy bear parachute.
Oh,
and they're going to
chuck
be giving...
them off the cliff.
What exactly. Yeah. With a parachute, so they won't die. They'll be all right. So bring your teddy bears down. But they've got factual stuff about fires, but there's also lots of fun stuff and all usual sort of face painting and things like that going on. And finally, on Sunday, come down and say hello to me. I'm doing the I will be outside the cells. This is part of Heritage Open Days. I'll be outside the cells, no, outside, on doing the giant Monopoly. So if anybody wants to come and say hello
I've
to me.
I've seen the signs for that.
I would love to see
them.
Well,
Claire, hopefully
get a bit lonely
we're going to
there.
Put the Heritage Open Day up on our Facebook, the link.
Fantastic.
I've certainly never heard of that. I didn't know about that website.
It's amazing. There are loads and
Heritage
loads of
Open Days.
Yes.
You just Google that.
It's a national thing. And it's all. There are loads of things going on all over the country.
How does the giant Monopoly work?
Oh, it's fab.
It's, you say that every
you know,
year.
It's so just
you're always
go
a bit enthusiastic
it,
about it.
I know,
that,
I love it. I've done it a few
it's
years
like David
running.
Bellamy enthusiastic.
Are we still Mayfair on the Monopoly board?
I think we are.
Yeah.
Mayfair and Exeter, aren't we? St Albans and Exeter are Mayfair and Park Lane.
Really?
I believe, yes.
Posh,
yes.
Then.
Very posh, yes. Yes, of course. Basically, well, it's a treasure hunt around the city centre, really. You have a little laminated board that you take around. You have various stop-off points that you visit, and they are part of the Heritage Open Day. The sales are only open on this day every year. So it's a good opportunity, and if you haven't been down there, they're cold, they're damp, and they're a bit scary, but they take you on a guided tour down there.
Ooh.
And it's part that you stop off at the old railway station. There, oh, all sorts of things. But the way it links in with Monopoly is if you don't get the clues right, you have to do a forfeit, or so there are activities going on at each stop-off point.
And what sort of age group would that be for?
I would say probably the under 11s. It's
okay.
Because you can push a pushchair. It is a walk, really. Some people drive from place to place, but you really, ideally, you need to walk so you can take dogs. I've stood outside the cells holding dogs before because people have gone in there and can't take the dogs in. So it's great. It's just a nice family day out. You can walk around the city centre, see places that you've never seen before, get a bit of exercise, and find out a bit about our local heritage, really. Each year it's slightly different, but I believe it starts at 11 o'clock and it's outside the town hall. That's where you can sign up, and it's free.
What?
Don't often hear that.
We're all broke
it
after the summer
free.
Holidays. I
yeah.
have overindulged my children to such a degree just to keep them quiet. It's terrible. You just feel like, oh, they're so badly behaved now. They've been completely spoiled. They've had ice creams coming out of their ears for 2 months.
I'll take them to this and tell them it's very expensive. They need to appreciate
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
And it is completely free. So it is a really good event. I would really recommend it.
Brilliant.
As a family.
So
a family
shall we maybe try and put up that schedule on our Facebook, or can parents look on your website for the information?
They can look on our website for all the details. So if you want to put a link, if we have a link to it to the Raring to Go website, there will be all of that information on there.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us, Claire.
That's
as well. Thank
pleasure.
You, Lorenza, keeping
pleasure.
Me company in the studio tonight. Next week, we'll be talking to Jessica Chivers, who's the local thinking woman's coach. It's a bit scary, but sounds fabulous.
What's that about?
She is, well, she's a guru, basically, and she specialises in women returning to work. She's written a book. She's fabulous to speak to. I was on the phone to her last night talking about next week's show. You could talk to her for hours. She's fantastic. She's going to be on talking about how women drag themselves back to work and how they find the energy and get over the guilt and cope with all the demands.
How
do they do it all? Yeah, we're going to try and find some women who can do it all. But thank you so much for joining us, everybody. And we'll see you next week. All the best.
Neave Solicitors are proud to sponsor The Parent Show. The friendly